Right. Hi, everyone. I hope this is a good time to talk more about computer systems. Agenda, okay, logistics, nothing surprising there. You should be very familiar. It's up on the website. But if a reminder is helpful, last time we were talking about deadlock and we started on monitors. Today we're going to continue the discussion on monitors, and then the second half of the class we will switch to our next topic, which will be computer networking. Before we get into that, is there any questions or concerns before we start? No. Great. All right. Wonderful. So where were we? We were discussing this notion of a monitor where we're combining a lock with condition variables, shared state, and then some code that's going to execute on that shared state. And the idea was that if we design this in a particular way, it can be very helpful for allowing multi-threaded code to be correct. And so, for example, one rule is that we always have to acquire the lock before we access any internal state.
So
we were looking at an example here of how we can build monitors using the primitives from the pthread library. Now, this is designed to be sort of a simple example. We have two operations that are both using this shared Boolean, this finished variable. And then we have the lock. We have the lock that we're going to have to acquire before we can access this variable, and then our condition variable to coordinate between the two threads. Now, as mentioned, the key, we always have to have the lock before we can access any of that shared state. So both of these operations, these functions, which we assume are going to run in separate threads, must acquire a lock first, and then sort of their last operation is to unlock or release that lock. Inside of here, we also need to use the condition variable. And so when we implement the wait for finished operation, we have to check, well, is this finished? Is the Boolean finished set to true? Now, we can do this safely because we've acquired the lock. Oh, okay. All right. Sorry. Okay. Because we've acquired the lock. So that's okay. So that's good. So we can access finished. And then we need to check. Is it already finished? If it is, then we're done. If it's not finished, that's when we actually want to wait until it has finished. So we have to do that check. And then we can use the condition wait function, which has this nice property where it does essentially three operations together. It releases our hold on the lock. This allows something else to then acquire the lock. It does the wait. And then before it returns, it reacquires the lock. And so this is very helpful for implementing this correctly. And so when we get to this stage and we need to do the wait, we want to make sure that we've released the lock so that the other thread can actually access that same shared state. Then we want to wait until we sort of get notified via this condition variable. In the other operation, the finish function, which is going to be in a different thread, it needs to acquire the lock, of course. Then it can set finish to true. And at that point, now it can notify other threads that might be waiting on this condition that, hey, this something has changed. And so it notifies on this condition variable. And then we have to give up the lock so that now that the other thread can access it. And so that's a basic operation of this monitor concept. We can if these two threads coordinate. The sharing is safe because both threads acquire a lock and only access that shared state once they have the lock. And then the thread can notify the other thread to say, something has changed, you should check again and continue. Any questions? Yeah. That's correct. So the question is, when we call pthread condition wait here, we have to be very careful what arguments we pass. So we definitely want to pass the condition variable we want to wait on and the lock that we currently hold. And so we just need the one lock here. And so typically this should be pretty straightforward. But this is the lock that we will release and then reacquire. And so it needs to match the one that we took earlier. Okay, so with this structure, we can look at some potential executions. And so in this timeline, so time is sort of progressing down in this figure, we get a lot of interleaving. And so this is sort of akin to these threads running at the same time. And so here, the wait for finish thread first tries to take the lock and succeeds and gets the lock. Meanwhile, the finish thread also tries to acquire the lock, but only one thread can hold it at a time, so it's going to be waiting. Now, because the wait for finish thread has the lock, it can check for the finished flag. Now, if this is false, so it's not finished, then we will go inside this loop and call wait. Now, what does that do? So remember, that starts the waiting process, which means we give up the lock and then start waiting. Because we've now given up the lock, the other thread that was waiting on the lock can now acquire that lock. And so it will. With the lock, it can now access that shared state, setting finish to true. Now it wants to notify other threads. And so in this case, we're using an example of a broadcast, so it'll notify all of the threads. In this example, we just have the one. That the condition has changed, right? And so again, we're using our specific condition variable here. Now that that broadcast has happened, that means that the condition we were waiting on has changed, and so we're done waiting. And instead, we'll now be trying to reacquire the lock because our wait function has to reacquire the lock before it can return. However, that can't happen until the thread that holds the lock gives it up. Once that happens, we're done waiting. But now, again, we are still in that while loop. And so we'll do the check again. However, this time, finished will be true. So we won't actually execute the body of that while loop. And at that point, we have finished. And so even though these two operations are sort of interleaved, this is safe. Because we've made sure that both sides have taken the lock, they only access the shared data while they have the lock, and they appropriately give up the lock so that the other thread can run when it's ready to, when there's work for it to do. Any questions on this timeline of events? In contrast, we can look at one that's slightly different, right? We can look at one where they're sort of not interleaving. This is kind of what might happen if these threads don't sort of run at exactly the same time. In this example, the finished thread actually runs first, and so it's able to acquire the lock, change the variable, broadcast, which is fine, although there's nothing waiting, and then unlock. And then when the wait for finish thread eventually runs, it too tries to acquire the lock. The lock is available, so it can do that. It will still do the check, but finish is true, so the while loop body won't happen. And it's basically done at that point and can release the lock. So both executions are perfectly valid. They're both safe. It just depends on exactly when those threads are scheduled to run on the processor. Questions? There's one question we've sort of alluded to, right? Which is, what's happening here? Right? Why are we checking this condition in a loop? Because if you think about it, intuitively, sort of, either the condition should be, the condition is either going to be true or false. If it's false, if what we're looking for has not happened, then we wait. If what we're looking for has happened, then we don't wait, as in this example. But even when we do wait, that condition should change, and then we get the broadcast or the signal. And so we should be able to resume running. And the point that the reason we've stopped waiting is because whatever we were waiting for has changed. So why do we need to do this extra check? Or why do we need to do this check in the loop? There's a couple answers to this question. The first is basically because the documentation says we have to. So if you look up the documentation for pthread conditional wait, well, it says that this idea that spurious wakeups could occur, meaning that it's possible that this function returns even though the nothing has changed. Like, that condition variable didn't really change, it just returned. So that would be a spurious wake up. And so to protect against that, we have to make sure that even if that happens, we go back, we double check, make sure that what we're actually waiting for has actually happened before we continue. And if we don't do that, we're going to have some very strange behavior in our program, because this is probably unlikely to happen. But if it did, now suddenly the code would continue even though that condition wasn't true, and that could lead to some bad or strange behavior. So this is one reason. We'll see another reason in a bit. But now we can sort of expand our example a little bit. So the wait for finished highlights the different elements, but it's a still pretty simple kind of contrived example. We can look at something that's a little bit more realistic. So in this case, we're going to assume that we have two threads, one that's trying to, or that's producing. So it's adding something to a queue, and another that's consuming. It's dequeuing things from the queue and doing something with that. And you can imagine a host of different program situations where this might be desirable. So we have some thread that's running that's maybe collecting data or generating data somehow that it wants to put into the queue, or maybe it's generating tasks or it's requests coming in from the network. And then we have something else running that can handle those requests or make sense of that data. And so we often want to have this style of decoupling and structure our programs this way. Now, for this particular case, we're considering an unbounded queue. Now, not feasible really to implement such a thing that's truly unbounded, because we have to store the data somewhere. But for the sake of our illustration here, we're going to assume that we can always add something new to the queue. We, of course, have our lock, and then we have a condition variable data ready, and this is going to tell us when there's actually something in the queue that we can process. Okay, and then we have our two operations, produce and consume. Now, of course, the first thing we see, right, is that both operations acquire the lock first and release it last. This is essential, right? We have to do this, because if we don't, these two threads could access the same state at the same time, leading to some very, again, strange and undesirable behavior. Things like them using the same element to both enqueue and dequeue, and data get lost. And the worst part is, this is probably not going to happen every time. It's going to come up very sporadically. And you're going to get bug reports being like, I put data in the queue, and then it just disappeared. And you're going to look at the code, and there's nothing that should do that, but synchronization failures could. So we definitely have to be careful that we absolutely lock and unlock before we access anything to do with the shared state, in this case, the buffer. Okay, so we do that. Now, if we look at the consume call, the consumer's job is to pull something out of the queue and handle it. And so the first thing it needs to do is check, well, is there anything in the queue? If the buffer is not empty, then we can go ahead and dequeue, and we'll get here. Right, and we can pull out the item from the buffer, make our own sort of copy of it. Now we can go and process that ourselves. That's totally fine. And so that's why we can unlock the lock. However, if the buffer is empty, then this will match, right? And so we'll actually go inside this while loop, and that's where we call our wait. And so we're going to wait for data ready and then release the lock and then go back and then go to a waiting state for something else to change what's in the queue. On the producer side, after acquiring the lock, it can add the item to the queue. And then after that, signal that, okay, there's now something ready, right? There's data ready. And so it's going to signal a waiting thread so that it knows that, so that now it can go and handle that. Now, there may not be a thread that's waiting, and that's okay. But if there are, they will sort of get notified and can continue executing. So far, so good. Any questions on this setup? Has a similar flow to what we've seen, right? Okay, but getting back to this issue, right, of this while loop. So we can ask, well, how many times is this while loop going to execute? How many times are we going to execute what's inside here? Well, we don't know for sure because it's going to depend on the order that these operations actually execute when they actually run on a processor. But we can walk through some of the possibilities. So is it possible that the while loop never executes? There's no iterations. Sure, right? We've actually seen that. So if the producer runs first and it's able to lock, enqueue, signal, and unlock, and all of this happens before the consumer starts, well, now there will be something in the buffer. And so after the consumer, of course, after it acquires the lock, right, it will check empty. It's not empty. So I don't need to wait because the condition's already there. And so it can go ahead and dequeue and continue from there. So totally valid that the while loop will never have any iterations. We won't execute that wait statement. What about it executing one time? Can that happen? Well, if we have our setup here again with two threads, but in this case, the consume thread actually started executing earlier. It called lock, it checks in that while statement, and now it is empty. There's nothing in the queue. Well, now we will enter and actually do an iteration of the loop, and that's what calls wait. And so this lets the thread wait until there is something to do. Now, at that point, the produce thread runs. The lock was given up because wait releases the lock, so the produce thread can actually acquire the lock. Add data, signal, and unlock. When it signals, now there is a thread waiting, and so the system will move that thread as it's no longer waiting, and now it's trying to acquire the lock. Because again, conditional wait needs to acquire the lock before it returns. But it can't just acquire the lock because the produce thread still has it until it calls unlock. That allows the consumer thread to actually acquire the lock. Now we can return from conditional wait. We return here, but we're still in this while loop. So we're going to go back, do the check again. Right? So that's we're going to do the check. Now we look at empty. Well, it's no longer empty. And so the check doesn't fail. We do not execute another iteration of that loop. Instead, we go on and do the dequeue. And so we get our one iteration of that loop. So arguably, this is kind of what we would expect, right? The consumer is going to run. It doesn't know that there's anything in the buffer. It checks. There isn't. It now just calls wait. And when the thread starts running again because the wait is finished, well, that was signaled because now there is something in the buffer. And so when it checks again, voila, there is. And it can pull it out and continue. It's kind of what we would expect to happen. Can we have more iterations? If the answer is no, we could never have more, then the if statement approach would be okay. But if it's possible that we would want to iterate this loop more than once, that's why we need to have the while loop. So we mentioned the one case, which is the spurious wake-ups case, where the system, the wait does return, but the condition variable wasn't actually set, and there is actually nothing to do, and so you just want to go back to waiting. But is there another case? What would it take for sort of a normal execution of this program to have another iteration? Aha, yeah, exactly. What if there was another thread? So what if you set this all up, and then the customer said, well, actually, we don't think this is going to be good enough. We think we're going to need more than one consumer to keep up with our requirements. Okay, and so your manager says, hey, we need to have more threads. And you're like, that's not a problem, right? Because I use this monitor pattern correctly, so I can have another consumer thread. No problem. But what's going to happen then? Right? Or what could happen? So now if we have a third thread, and this one is also calling consume, well, now we could get interleaving like this, where, again, our second thread from before does start running first. It calls wait. The producer does run and enqueues an element into the queue. That signal afterwards will cause the waiting thread to no longer be waiting. Now it's going to try to acquire the lock. But in the meantime, our new thread, sort of our additional consumer, that's going to hopefully make this increase the performance and make our customer happy, is also waiting for the lock, right? Because that's the first thing that happens here. Now, in this example, the third thread is the one that's going to actually get the lock, meaning our thread two is going to remain waiting. Now, this consume thread is, so basically that lock is now here. So we're here, it's going to run the while loop, check if buffer is empty. It's not, right? Because the producer did put something into the queue. So empty is no, and so it'll go ahead, skip the loop, call dequeue, and then continue, but it does call unlock. So once this unlock happens, that then triggers that thread two can now acquire that lock that it was also waiting for. However, what's now happened? Even though it was signaled correctly, when this wait, So this thread here. So if we get the lock, this condition wait has now returned, right? But now when we go back and do this while loop here, this check, well, guess what happens, right? The buffer is, in fact, empty again because the thread 3 dequeued the item before this thread 2 was able to run, and so it's empty again. And so what do? Well, that's okay. We'll just go back to waiting, right? And so we'll just run this wait again and wait for the condition to signal again. But the result is that we have actually waited, or we've iterated that loop twice now, right? And it's possible this could keep happening depending on future execution of the program. Questions? Awesome. Okay. And so we think about, okay, why do we use this while loop? Well, it's for exactly the more common cases is situations like this, where even with our condition variable, it's entirely possible that we get woken up and something else has, again, changed the state again. And so we want to make sure that we do that check again. And then the other key here is that when we do the check, we always have the lock. And so we know that between when we do the check and then when we actually try to use, like, say, do this dequeue here, nothing could have changed, right? Because we held the lock for the entire time. All right. What questions do you have? So that's a good question. So who gets the lock when a thread is waiting for it and a signal or broadcast happens? And so kind of something interesting happened here, right? The producer signaled, we had a thread that was waiting, it stopped waiting, but notice it did not get the lock. And so this is a design choice. Should the signal sort of pass the lock with the signal? Or is the signal simply move all threads that are waiting in back into trying to acquire the lock and then give the lock to a thread, regardless of what was signaled? So in this example, right, it did not follow the signal. And this is, again, a design choice. So pthreads is not going to make this guarantee that even if one thread was signaled and some other thread was just waiting on the lock, who gets the lock is not guaranteed. Now, there are sort of two different general designs here. The one that's more common is these MESA-style monitors where there's no connection here or there's no guarantee. A Hoare-style monitor is sort of the implementation where when you signal, you pass the lock in effect with the signal. So these are both design options, but again, it's more common to sort of just not add that additional guarantee. Okay. All right, so we've been talking about this unbounded case, right? This sort of hypothetical case where we just have the ability to continuously store in our queue. To make this a little bit more realistic, we can consider a bounded queue. Much more feasible to implement, of course, but now we have the case where there's nothing in the queue or that the queue is full and there's no room to add more to the queue. And so to handle this, we're going to have not one but two condition variables, and each one's going to correspond to each one of those events. So data ready is the same as before. There's something in the queue that can be pulled out, or space ready is now our new thing, which is the queue went from full to no longer full. And so if there's something else to be added, there's now room to add it. Our structure is going to look sort of very similar, right? We both produce and consume still acquire the lock, of course. But now our producer has a condition variable and a check that it needs to do. So it needs to check, is the buffer full? If it is, then we need to wait. But we're going to wait for space ready. We're still going to release the same lock. Now, on the consumer side, once we've taken something out of the buffer by calling dequeue, now we're going to signal on the other condition variable to say, well, I've taken something out, so now there's space. And so if anything was waiting on there being space, that condition is now ready, and that thread should run. And so it's the same idea, we can add additional conditions. There's no requirement that we just have the one condition, and we can have one lock that covers that covers really the shared data, and we can have an arbitrary number of conditions. So far, so good? So as we've been looking at these examples, we've been using sort of two methods to notify other threads. So one is the signal here and here, but we've also seen examples of broadcast. And so one question is there a right and wrong option? What happens if you were to pick the wrong option if such a thing exists? And so like one question we could ask is, what would happen if we replace this signal with a broadcast? Intuitively, signal sort of makes sense, right? Because we've removed one thing from the queue. That would free up one spot, and so we want to notify one thread that's waiting for there to be room in the queue so that it can presumably add something to that queue. If we broadcast, now we would be waking up many threads, potentially, that are waiting on that. But if there's only one spot left, a lot of those threads are going to find that there is still no room. And so this may be a little bit inefficient. However, what's important here is that because we did this correctly, right? Because we put our check in the while loop, even if we notify a bunch of threads, most of whom just see the buffer still full, the program will still execute correctly. Because even though the condition returns, we do the check again, they will see that the buffer is still full, and they'll go back to waiting. And so that correctness is very, very important. Even if maybe it would be undesirable to have all these threads suddenly do the same check, and then all realize that there's still no room. Does that make sense? Any questions? Yeah.
Can you replace lock functionality with condition variables like altogether? Or do locks do player being player full?
Can we implement replace the lock functionality with condition variables? No. Short answer. Right, those are serving sort of two different purposes. Because even if we don't want to wait on a condition, we still need something that gives us exclusive access to the state. Okay. All right, another sort of question here. So we've got these two condition variables, right? Space ready and data ready. Is it strictly required that we have two? Well, so for kind of the same reasoning about the broadcast, it would be possible to implement this with a single ready condition variable. Now, both producers and consumers would be waiting on the same condition, and then both producers and consumers would be notifying and signaling or broadcasting on the same condition. But again, because we've implemented this correctly and used these while loops, even if we get a notification or the thread wakes up and the condition variable was actually used for the condition we didn't want, that's okay because we do the check. And so again, there's another chance that we get these kind of spurious wake-ups, or what looks to our program as a spurious wake-up. And so again, it's very, very important that we check the condition in a while loop because of all of these different factors, especially if you think about how the code could evolve. If, again, if like a new requirement comes in, you want to now run with more threads, or somebody changes something in another file, we want to be defensive and ensure that we're checking in the loop just in case something has changed, and now these extra wake-ups are possible. Okay, and so as we're seeing here, right, there's definitely a pattern emerging. Right, the way we interact with these monitor designs is there's sort of a set of kind of rules of thumb conditions that we need to do, and so the general structure is that we start by acquiring the lock, of course, because we can't check any of that. We can't access, I should choose my words here. To make a correct program, we must not access any shared state. Will the compiler allow it? In C? Yeah. Will the processor allow it? Sure, processor doesn't care. Would our program be wrong? Yes. Will things break? Yes. So the lock is only as effective as our ability to actually call it and correctly and use it correctly. So we have to make sure that we're acquiring the lock first before we access any of the internal state. Then we check our condition in a while loop. If our condition is not true, we need to wait. Now, it's important that we call this wait function because that will release the lock so something else can run, and then make sure that we reacquire the lock after the condition variable has changed. Now, once we do that, we can continue. We are going to loop in this while loop here. If this check is now true and we don't execute inside the while loop, because we hold the lock, this if statement is fine. All right, it's fine to, we can actually, and then we do some work and now we set condition A. Well, we want to notify other threads of that. If we had set condition B, we can broadcast notify other threads of that. And then finally, of course, at the end, we need to release the lock so that some other thread can acquire it. So this is the general pattern and the types of requirements that I've been talking through as we look at these examples. This slide just kind of summarizes those. Right? If you follow these rules, then we get a correct use and implementation of the monitor design, and that enables that safe sharing between multiple threads. And also we've talked about that it's actually okay to broadcast even if signal would have been just fine. It's okay to broadcast and signal even if nothing has actually happened because, again, the waiting thread is always checking in a loop. And similarly, we could use multiple conditions with one condition variable, again, because we're always checking that condition every time. And then finally, we've been sort of omitting the init code in these examples to make them easier to fit on the slide, but there are library functions for creating these data structures and then the corresponding to destroy to release the resources. Yeah. Yeah, so what does a condition variable look like? Let's go back real quick here. Where is it? And so from a sort of like how the monitor is, you know, is organized and what's happening here, we basically, the condition variables are basically a list of things that are waiting. And so when we wait on the condition variable, we're adding ourselves, adding a thread, to that list. And so now when we call signal or broadcast, the system knows, okay, which what threads are potentially waiting for this and can respond accordingly. All right. Okay. All right. Any other questions? All right. Let's look at an example. So here we're implementing similar to what we saw before with wait for finished, except now we have finished is two elements. And so we're looking for both elements of this array to be finished. So let's take probably 2 minutes. What goes in that top blank? And please discuss, collaborate with your neighbors as you think through this. Any takers for A? What about B? C? D? E? F? I don't know. All right. So if we look at these options here, what's interesting is that A is the condition that we want, like that's what we're waiting for, right? We want both things to be finished. But if we put that in this while loop, then we're going to iterate that, we're going to keep staying in that while loop while the thing that we're looking for is true, which is not really what we want, because we'll just kind of keep waiting, even though the thing we're waiting for has already happened. If we look at B here, there weren't, I don't think, any takers for B, you know, that doesn't quite make sense. If we look at C, however, so what's C checking for? So it would be while either the first element isn't finished or the second element isn't finished. And since we're looking for both, this is the condition that we want to wait on. And so as long as one one or both of those is not true, aka not finished, then we want to keep going back into our wait. And we're going to keep doing that until that until that's no longer true. And yeah, the one or the other doesn't help us. Okay, what about the bottom block? What should go there? Any takers for A? What about B? C? Any for D? E? F? Don't know? All right. Okay. So if we look at these options, if we were to do just the signal, and if we only have the two threads, this should be totally fine, right? Because we've been talking about how having these sort of spurious wake-ups, in this case, the finished thread, or the finished operation, maybe it's both are finished, maybe not. But in either case, because we're doing the check correctly, it's okay. We'll just go back to waiting if it's not. Now, if we had multiple waiting threads for wait for both finished, we would want to broadcast to all of them. Again, even if the condition isn't met, it's still safe and okay to broadcast to all of them. They'll just do the check and go back to waiting. If not, these options sort of also fit and maybe would reduce some of these spurious wake-ups. Again, if there's one possible wait for both finished thread, or maybe if there's multiple, they would both be okay. And so we actually have some flexibility here with exactly how we signal depending on how this is being run. All right. Okay, so that's, we're going to wrap up, end our discussion about synchronization, deadlock, threads, monitors, locks, all of that here. So let's take a quick break, and we'll switch to our new topic.
Interesting.
All right. Oh, I guess I have to. Okay, there we go. All right, our next topic is going to be networking. All right, why are we talking about networking? And I argue there's a couple good reasons. If I can advance the slide here. So I would argue the internet is one of the most successful computer applications we've ever built. And it's to the point now where it impacts virtually every aspect of our lives, of how society functions. Nearly every program that we run has some networked functionality, right? There's very few that are truly an offline application these days. And this success is pretty significant. If we look at the number of internet users over time, and this is from a little bit earlier this year, I mean, more than 5.5 billion global users. Now, that's not everyone, right? The access to the internet is definitely not sort of evenly distributed globally, which is something to keep in mind as everything becomes connected. But it is still a massive number of users, and it supports a wide range of use cases. So this is kind of a list of what people have cite that they use the internet for. And this is across all age groups. And so we've got this system that's both incredibly important, widely used, and used for a whole range of different use cases. And perhaps complicating things even more is that on a technical level, these use cases are not the same. So this is based on what people say that they use the internet for. But if you look at from sort of a what does the network have to do perspective, the actual data for different applications is wildly different. So what is the internet really doing? Well, it's really helping us stream video. Right? That's where a majority of the actual bits, the data, are used for. And the other applications, I mean, they're not nothing, right? I mean, you know, this is still a staggering amount of data. But in terms of just a pure data point of view, it's much, much, much lower. So from a computer systems point of view, we need to design something that's global scale, highly performant, supports a diverse set of use cases, works across a range of different devices and device types, and can handle very different technical performance requirements depending on the application. That's not easy to do. Right? It is much easier to implement a system where the specification is very clear, it's laid out, it's singular purpose. Much more difficult to make something that's flexible enough to support what the internet needs to support. And so the key to actually making this possible, I argue, is that we have to be very careful with how we design the abstractions in networking. And the primary abstraction we have from a programmer's point of view is what's called a socket. And we actually discussed this way back in the first day of class, that a socket is sort of the main abstraction for our programs to access the network. And because this design turns out to be quite flexible, it looks a lot like opening and reading and writing a file. We open a socket, we get a file descriptor, and then we can send and receive data using that file descriptor. Importantly, the abstractions are not making us deal with a lot of the complexity that comes with supporting so many different use cases. The layer that we see supports sort of this idea that there's a connection between two remote machines and they can exchange data. We can model this by looking at a mailbox model, sort of akin to sending a letter, like a physical letter through the mail, where our goal is that we want to have some machine, right? That could be our phone, laptop, could be a server here at UVA, that wants to communicate to some other machine, which could be something in the same room, in the same campus, in the same state, or elsewhere around the world. And the goal is that we should be able to take some message, have a destination in mind, in this case B, send it to this network, and the network is then going to be responsible and provide its best effort, do its best to get that message over to B. A will call send, B will call receive, and all of the complexity of getting here to there, that's taken care of by the network. Now, we don't have sort of infinite space, and so, and the network doesn't have infinite capacity, I should say. So machine A is going to have a queue of outgoing messages. So messages will enter the queue, and then as it can, it will send. And then similarly on the receiving side, messages will queue there until the machine is actually able to then handle that message. And so just like we would have a mailbox on either end, we have a similar concept in computer networks. And so in practice, this is how many applications and this sort of design of this network looks like. We are going to send letters or packets in the networking sense, and instead of putting them inside an envelope, we use what's called a header to identify where this packet has come from, where it's supposed to go. And so that way, every step along the way in the network, it knows what it should do with this. Importantly, our networks are what's called best effort. So this means to make this work, they're going to try to get your message, your letter, your packet to the intended recipient, but there's no guarantee that will happen. Guarantees are hard, especially hard to do when you've got 5.5 billion people using the system. And so we back down the promises a little bit, but that, of course, has implications for how we design these systems because we have to handle the fact that it's best effort and not a guarantee. And so it's possible that the message doesn't even get through at all, or if you send multiple messages, what order they will be received in, there's no guarantee. Now, again, from our point of view, we have a socket abstraction, and we sort of hide some of these details at lower layers. If we look at this idea of connections, so this is sort of the model that we want to have. We want to have our local machine connect to some remote machine, and then they can exchange data. To do that, we have to establish the connection. And so we're going to use the same ability to pass messages back and forth to do this. Machine A is going to send a connection request to B. Machine B can accept that connection request by sending back the accept. Now there's a connection established, and so A can send data within that connection, B can receive data within that connection, and this is bidirectional. And so B can also send data back, which then A can receive. So these are some of the high-level abstractions that networks provide. Especially for us as programmers, we're going to say we want to initiate the connection, and then once that's happened, we can send data back and forth. To make this effective, what we've learned over time, over the decades of building network systems like this, is that having layers makes this much more tractable. So this is really one of those key insights to how do we deal with this diverse set of use cases and the complexity of connecting things at a global scale is by breaking things into layers and having those layers responsible for very specific tasks. So as programmers, we're mostly going to be concerned with the application layer. When we write a networked application, we're interacting at the application layer. As we go down, layers like the transport layer has its sort of responsibility. Transport layer is often going to be implemented by the operating system. The network layer is what really understands this notion that there's this global set of devices that are connected in a certain way and how messages should get from one place to another. The link layer is much more local. It's really about how should two nearby devices communicate to exchange information. And then finally, the physical layer, how do we actually encode the underlying bits, the information, in a way that we can physically get it from one device to another. So by separating these tasks into these layers, not only does that break down this really large, challenging problem into something arguably much more manageable, but you can see here in this middle column, these are different protocols that implement each of these layers. And so we often have multiple options. And the reason is because different protocols, different implementations, are going to provide different types of functionality. And so for all these different use cases, depending on what we require, we can choose what to use at different layers. So for example, if we want to have mobile devices, then Wi-Fi is a much better option than Ethernet, which requires a cable. And we'll talk about some of the variations of these different protocols as we go. We also break down these layers with slightly different terminology. So we'll call the messages that we send segments or packets or frames depending on which layer, what perspective we have. So if we're thinking about, say, the link layer, which would be concerned with how does a wireless packet get from your laptop to the access points, of which there are four in this room, that's going to be operating on frames. So it's sort of a terminology for different layers. And the layers also build upon each other. Hence the idea that these are layered. And so to implement particular set of features, we're going to need support from multiple layers to do that. And so these layers are critical to making modern networks functional and scalable. Any questions so far? All right, so for our discussion in this class, what we're going to do is we're going to look at some really critical properties and try to get a sense of the types of techniques we use to deal with the complexities of the real world, of actually building a global internet. And so the first one we're going to think about is reliability. So I mentioned before that the network is best effort. And that really stems from the fact that this is infrastructure that we're using that we have no direct control over. Right? If we have our device here, which is attached to, say, the UVA network, and then the UVA network has an upstream provider, and then these large ISPs like AT&T that span over continents, and then connect to these sort of main links that connect to other networks on other continents. There's a lot of infrastructure between our device here and some server attached to some other network. And that's not under our direct control. So to make all this work, they're going to try their best, but they're not going to guarantee us that if we send something, it will absolutely be received and make it to the endpoint, and it's not going to guarantee that whatever we sent won't be corrupted, won't be delayed, or won't be reordered. So there's a host of challenges in these real-world networks that we have to deal with if we want to have reliable communication, and arguably we do want to have reliable communication. So first, let's look at what happens if messages can be lost. So in real networks, messages can absolutely be lost, and this can happen because somewhere in its journey, going from router to router through multiple networks, maybe one of those routers was just sort of overloaded, and it basically ran out of space to store your particular message. Well, what can it do? It has nowhere to store it, and so it just gets lost. What we want is the picture on top, right? This is what we expect. We send something from machine A, it arrives to machine B. Fair enough. However, what happens if this case happens, right? What happens if that message gets lost? From machine A's point of view, right? If we just look at what machine A sees in these cases, it's identical. In both cases, it sent a message. So how does machine A know that this message was not, in fact, lost and actually made it to machine B? Any ideas? Yeah. Exactly. Right? So the intuition is, well, if we do receive this correctly, let's have a response. So it might look something like this. Have machine B say, yep, I got it. And so this is what we call an acknowledgement. B is basically acknowledging that it received the message from A by sending a response that just says, yes, I received the message. What happens if that message is lost? Well, now, again, to A, it looks the same, but B has no idea, right? B doesn't know that machine A was trying to send something. It doesn't have some sort of way to just perceive that A must have trying to send something. It just doesn't receive anything. What do we do now? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So A can sit around and wait and say, okay, well, I know that B is supposed to send me back an acknowledgement. Let me wait to see if that happens. If it doesn't get the reply, then it can decide, well, I'm just going to have to resend this. Right? I did not get an acknowledgement. I don't think that the message got through. Let me retransmit. That one actually succeeds. Then we get the acknowledgement. Great. Are we done? What are you thinking?
One slight thing that you have to deal with is, let's say machine A sends a message, machine B receives it, sends back acknowledgement, but then an acknowledgement.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, right? If this message can get lost, well, by that logic, this one could as well, right? This one could potentially be lost as well. So B gets the original message, sends back the acknowledgement gets lost. What do we do now? Takers for A, send a got it. How about B? C? What about D? None of these, okay. So we have some options. If we go with A, and essentially what we're going to be doing is acknowledging the acknowledgement, That kind of leads us down an interesting path, right? Because now, if that acknowledgement, if the got it, gets through, now B should then notify A that that happened, right? And so then B should send back a got it. But then B wouldn't know if that message got through, so then A would have to send a got it. And so on and so forth. And so acknowledging acknowledgments becomes challenging for this reason. If B just sort of speculatively sends an acknowledgment again, it doesn't really know if it should do that or how many times it should do that. And so that's difficult. C turns out to be pretty effective. Basically, have A resend the message as though the original message was lost. And that kind of covers both cases, right? So even if the acknowledgement was lost, and so B got the data, but machine A doesn't know that, A needs to resend because A doesn't know what happened. Can't tell if it was received or not. And so we can sort of use the same logic before and just retransmit. So we'll have some sort of timeout here. Oops, that's not very clear. And then after that timeout, we go ahead and retransmit. And then hopefully that time we get the acknowledgement. Good? Yeah. Right, okay. So if we look at this, we say, okay, all right, I see how this handles the problem where we're not sure if the message got through, so we retransmit it, okay. But if you look at what B is seeing now, what's happening if we just look at B's half? Well, it got a message. Okay, great, the meeting's at noon. It sent back its acknowledgement. Just like it was supposed to. A little while later, it got a message, says the meeting is at noon. It goes, okay, sends back an acknowledgement, just like it's supposed to. And so now B has received this twice. Now, you know, arguably in this case, that's okay, I guess. Like if you remind someone the meeting's at noon, that probably doesn't cause a problem. But you could imagine if other types of messages, you wouldn't want them to be received twice. Like debit this amount of money from your bank account, things like that, right? That really has a meaning if it happens more than once. So this is where we'll pick up next time on how we can address this case where we actually retransmit and the message is received twice. All right, see you on Thursday.